collectively read the War Powers Clause together?
So the War Powers Clause is located in Article 1, Section 8. So that's page 3 of this very helpful document. I will say one point among many about the great thing that Linda's doing here is that Linda has circulated this and reproduced this in larger page size. When you go and try to find the Constitution somewhere, as she pointed out in a radio interview the other day, it's often a small, tiny thing. At least here you can write in the margins and so forth. So we can find it together on Section 8, and it starts out, the Congress shall have power. And then it lays out all these different powers that the Congress shall have. And if you turn to page 4, and it's the third line down, to declare war. So that is known as the War Powers Clause. It obviously requires skipping a number of other lines to connect the clause. But that is the War Powers Clause. The Congress shall have power to declare war. And as we can see, the Congress has a number of other powers that are exclusively only for Congress. And that includes, to make all laws which shall be necessary and proper for carrying and execution the foregoing powers and so forth. So, you know, we cannot transfer any of these powers from Section 8 to the President of the United States, and that includes the power to declare war.
Question.
Yes.
You said that there was an exception to the War Powers Act.
Right.
That the executive has the power in the event of a direct attack.
Right.
Is that in the precedent?
It's a very good question. It's not in the text of the Constitution. The reason why it's understood that way is that the original language that the framers put forward in that debate I referenced in 1787 is that the Congress shall have power to make war. And the word make was originally the way it was phrased. And then the debate occurred over whether or not, if Congress was not in session, of course at that time Congress was often out of session, what would happen if Congress was out of session and the President needed to deal with a sudden attack. So in light of that debate, the word make was replaced with the word declare. And the framers specifically discussed this at the convention. Declare replaced make. And therefore, based on that constitutional history, it's well understood that there is this exception. Now, it's not to say that after a sudden attack and the President choosing to repel a sudden attack, that he doesn't need to still or she go to Congress to get a more formal declaration of war for something to continue. But if there is an absolute, clear sudden attack that occurs, that is the one exception the President has to repel. So people could argue that when it came to the September 11th episode and we had been attacked, people could argue that the bombing of Afghanistan was justified perhaps without any kind of congressional resolution. I don't argue that. I don't argue that because I don't think it was absolutely clear at that moment in time, on September 11th or 12th, that it was clearly coming from people in Afghanistan. As we know, 14 of the 19 hijackers were in Saudi Arabia. So if you want to go by, a greater percentage of where the hijackers were from, some people would argue bomb Saudi Arabia, right? So I think the point is that we didn't know right away then who had engineered the attack, and it required a congressional authorization. But even that aside, this question of Iraq did not involve a sudden attack. There was no basis whatsoever to make that argument, and the President wasn't even making it. In fact, just to extend that point even further, Senator Richard Durbin from Illinois tried to insert in the language of the resolution that the White House has presented an amendment that said that the President had the power to engage in taking the nation into war, necessary and appropriate, based on an imminent threat. Put the word imminent in there. And the White House opposed that vehemently, and he got the President got his supporters in Congress to oppose that, and the amendment was voted down 70-30. And importantly, Senator Kerry voted for that amendment. He agreed with Senator Durbin that the word imminent should be put in there. Now we know that there was no imminent threat, and even based on that historical knowledge, the President wasn't even claiming an imminent threat. This was to preempt some future threat down the road, and so that exception clearly does not apply here. Yes.
In spite of the fact that there was no exigency, there was despite the fact that no investigation has been conducted that demonstrated that there was anything other than a criminal act that had taken place.
Right.
And now, with the passage of time, it's clear that the president and in collusion with whatever his advisors and whatnot have committed criminal acts. Why is it that he is now running for re-election and no charges have been brought to laid at his doorstep?
Well, I think it's an excellent question, and it is why I agreed with the publisher of this book that the subtitle should be "The Case for Impeaching George W. Bush." You know, I'm not under any illusion that the Republican controlled Congress is going to start impeachment proceedings anytime soon. But I do believe that the charge of impeachment needs to be made. These are high crimes that the president has committed. And we have a provision in the Constitution for dealing with a president who goes beyond the bounds of the Constitution, defies the rule of law, and commits high crimes. And it's the provision on impeachment. And that charge ought to be made, that the president has committed impeachable offenses, that he's taken the nation into an illegal war, resulting in the deaths of thousands.
Well, my question is, and why has this not been done?
I think in part it's not been done because there's a fear that's been manufactured by this administration that is keeping people scared and therefore under the cloud that whatever the commander-in-chief thinks needs to be done ought to be done. Or, alternatively, if people disagree with the commander-in-chief, that we don't want to go down the road of creating a constitutional crisis of that magnitude of charging him with crimes. I have approached members of Congress about the impeachment charge, and they don't want, and these are sympathetic ones, and they don't want to do it because they feel that it will distract from this upcoming election and wanting to get through the election cycle. Now, you know, my response to that is twofold. First, there's no immunity whatsoever in the Constitution for presidential high crimes committed close to an election. And it's not like you're scot-free if you committed in year three or four of your term, but if you commit in year one or two, you're okay. The second, though, is that, as we know, President Nixon faced impeachment charges the year after he was reelected. And we ought not to be sitting here in January 2005 with a potential reseating of President Bush in the Oval Office and face at that point the question of did he commit impeachable offenses. We ought to deal with that question now, and it ought to be put forward before the people. But I think there's a lack of leadership in Washington that is willing to charge the president with what really he has done, which is engage in high crimes that have violated the Constitution and have defied the rule of law and have resulted in the deaths of thousands, including 900-plus U.S. soldiers dead. Yes?
I'm sorry, just to play the devil's advocate a little bit here. I mean, for the last, since World War II, there has been no war resolution.
Yes.
War officially declared by Congress.
Yes.
We've been working our way up to this new approach where these resolutions are passed which give the president this authority to act on behalf of Congress.
Yes.
Really. So, and in fact, these resolutions have turned into a different type of declaration of war. Are there legal scholars who are arguing that what they passed in October in Congress in 2002 was, in fact, a declaration of war, but for the modern era, or where you give freedom to the executive branch?
Well, first let me answer that by saying the New York Times recently reported on, you know, Senator Kerry's answer that the president pushed him to give. Would he, knowing what he knows now, have voted for the resolution back in October with the information that there are no weapons of mass destruction? And his answer was yes, and then he came under some criticism for that, and the New York Times reported an analysis piece soon after that, that his aides were pushing this argument that his vote for that resolution is far different than a vote for a declaration of war. So even the argument coming from that camp is that this was not a declaration of war. Certainly there were people who tried to explain this as a declaration of war, but any fair reading of the text of this resolution demonstrates that it was handing it over to the president. It was saying, as you deem it necessary and appropriate, you decide when and where to do this. And let me just come back to this formal declaration point, because that has actually been the mythology around the declaration of war requirement. It's not that Congress must utter some magic words to take the nation to war. It's true that since World War II, we haven't had a formal declaration of war, but we have had other instances in which Congress has engaged in authorizing the war through appropriations. There was no appropriation for this invasion, but there have been in the past. Through a mandatory draft, there was no mandatory draft. Congress had taken other actions during the Vietnam War when these cases were coming up that demonstrated its own involvement. At the time of this invasion, Congress had done nothing but pass, as this as Senator Byrd said, this rag of a resolution. And the text of it is clear. It doesn't say the president is authorized to go to war. It says the president is authorized to use the forces as he deems necessary and appropriate. In other words, he might not have to go to war. It's your call, Mr. President. You make the decision. That's precisely the point in which it no longer is equivalent to a declaration. It's either declaration of war or the cases say equivalent action, and it was neither in this case.
Well, it just seems to me that they did basically hand over. This is a new type of declaration of war that they that the Congress has been employing for the last 50 years for these kinds of actions. This is not the first time
I just want to finish my thought.
If the Congress declared war, mm-hmm. and the executive branch did not follow through on it, mm-hmm. what would happen then?
Then the president would be in violation of the Constitution as well, because Congress is.
But they would take it to court, and then there would be a conflict between one branch of the government and the other. I think what the issue is that our Congress failed us.
I think it's both. I think it's all three institutions failed us, but I certainly agree with you. Congress failed us, but I want to bring us back to this analogy of the income tax, because I do think the point is more clearly made when we think about it that way. Imagine if Congress had passed a resolution which said, you know, we're handing to you, Mr. President, the power to decide whether or not to levy a tax on the American people. We got deficit problems, we got these other issues, we're going to hand it to you. No one would argue that that's constitutional. No one would say that the president can now have this power. What's happened is there's been this mythology around what it means to be commander-in-chief. And somehow this idea that as a commander-in-chief, you land on an aircraft carrier, you say mission accomplished, and you can decide whether or not to take the nation into war. You can do all those things. And that's not what the commander-in-chief has the power to do. Okay. Alexander Hamilton was one of the staunchest supporters of executive power at the Constitutional Convention. Even he agreed that on this question, whether or not to take the nation into war, only the president has. So I actually disagree that it's equivalent to declaring war. It's not a new declaration of war. It's actually a wholly different animal. It's very, very different, and that's why Senator Byrd, I think, was so right to stand up to this and call it for what it was. It was an unconstitutional delegation to the president, giving him the decision-making power. One other analogy. If the Supreme Court had been handed this power, would we think at all there would be a possibility? What if Congress said...
We have to go back to the last 50 years, though. I mean, we can't just say that this action was wrong. It was illegal also what they did in Vietnam.
I don't dispute at all that there's been erosion of the War Powers Clause. But I do think that this particular invasion was the most egregious violation of the War Powers Clause this nation has ever seen. Why? Because this was this first use of the preemptive war doctrine. It was taking the nation into war based on a perceived threat that the president himself claimed existed. And the danger associated with allowing one individual to read the intelligence briefing or not and decide based on whatever he chose to do of evidence of a future threat That is far, far more dangerous than even as awful as the Vietnam War was, what was happening there. There, at least, there was some claim, false it was, that our ships in the Gulf of Tonkin had been attacked. There was no claim of that. This was a future threat. And I'll just, to hone in that point, Abraham Lincoln made a point on this in a letter that he wrote as a representative in Congress, a young representative in Congress in 1848, to his former law partner, William Herndon. And he, Abraham Lincoln, was opposing President James Polk's plans to send the nation to war with Mexico. And Herndon had argued that the United States ought to attack Mexico before it attacked this country. And in Lincoln's words, he stated this, it's even more relevant for our time. He said, "Allow the president to invade a neighboring nation whenever he shall deem it necessary to repel an invasion, and you allow him to do so whenever he may choose to say he deems it necessary for such purpose, and you allow him to make war at pleasure. Study to see if you can fix any limit to his power in this respect, after you've given him so much as you propose. If today he should choose to say he thinks it necessary to invade Canada, to prevent the British from invading us, how could you stop him? You may say to him, 'I see no probability of the British monarchy invading us,' but he will say to you, 'Be silent, I see it if you don't.'" That was essentially what was argued here. We have the intelligence. We know it. We have the special knowledge. Trust us. Trust us to protect the nation. Allow us to invade another nation and have Congress and the judiciary stay on the sidelines. And the danger is precisely the danger that Lincoln talked about. When we invest in one individual, that kind of trust, no matter how good or bad that person can be, we cannot engage in that, because this is, in fact, the most powerful military in the world now. And for us to go off and start wars in that kind of fashion with that one individual having that power walks us down the road to tyranny.
What about that judge, the one that decided for you that your case, you know, really shouldn't go forward? You know what I'm saying? 30 years ago he made a decision, and then he made it with you again. Isn't that a lot of power for one man? He's the one who made it, right?
He did, but there was an appeal. There was an appeal, and the three judges on appeal said the same thing. And I think they all gave up their responsibility. And
they all decided, all four, that
they did. They all four of them, the judge below and then the three judges who oversaw him, they all decided that they were not going to intervene, that only Congress and the president could be in conflict before they could intervene.
But don't you think, in a sense, that they were right then? If they all decided, don't they have to have a huge amount of material behind that to say that? And you know what I'm saying? You're a lawyer. I'm not talking, you know, I don't know all the specifics, but to have their strength, don't they have to have a lot of information behind that to say that? And are you saying that you still think they're all four wrong? You know, that's the judicial system. That's what I'm wondering.
Yeah, I think they're wrong. Mm-hmm. I think they're wrong. I think judges have been wrong before. Judges upheld slavery, and they were wrong then. Judges upheld separate but equal, in which we sanctioned segregation throughout this country for 50-plus years.
Dred Scott. Really
right.
Bad decision.
Exactly. And the judges were wrong in Bush v. Gore, in which for the first time in this nation's history, the Supreme Court selected the president rather than the people. So yes, I think judges can be wrong, have been wrong, sadly will be wrong into the future. The point here, though, is that it wasn't the responsibility of the judges to look at the intelligence briefings and determine whether or not there was a threat. That wasn't their responsibility. Their only responsibility was to look at what Congress had voted for and determine whether or not it was a declaration of war or equivalent. Somewhat broader than that, because some of these judges were Democratic appointees, and many of the people who voted for the resolution in Congress were Democrats, including the nominee for the Democratic Party for president. So this isn't about solely Republicans. This is about members of Congress, Democrats and Republicans, colluding with the president to violate the Constitution. They are as complicit. They are as complicit in their, and the complicity began with their act to hand over to the president this decision-making power, and it continued with the president marching us into this illegal war with the judiciary refusing to intervene. All three branches of government are complicit. But I don't think it's about one particular party engaging in this. I think it's actually those in power on both sides of the political aisle, Democratic, Republican, engaging in this unconstitutional behavior.
Do you feel frightened to come forward, the people that are members of Congress?
Well, let me read you this paragraph from the book. Despite these voices of dissent from Senator Byrd and others, most members of Congress, both on the Senate and House side, were too afraid to confront the president on this question so close to an election. The president has handcuffed us, Representative Robert Wexler of Florida told the Philadelphia Inquirer. I'm voting yes on this resolution because I think ultimately the box the president has put us in has forced us to vote in the interest of national security. Senator Byrd put it more bluntly. The wheels have been greased. So, yes, I think that there was a fear of standing up against this president on the eve of a national election in 2002 and telling the president, we're not going to give you this kind of unprecedented authority to decide on your own whether or not to invade Iraq. There was a fear in the wake of September 11th. There was a fear that they would be treated on election day in a way that made them look like they were weak on national security. And as we know, there is one U.S. senator who lost three limbs in Vietnam named Max Cleland, and he, in fact, did lose his seat in that election on a separate issue, which is that he wanted to ensure that the new Department of Homeland Security would comply with basic labor bargaining responsibilities, that the workers there could unionize and so forth, and he would not vote for the law and allowing that department to exist without that basic unionizing requirement, as did many, many other members of Congress. And the Republican Party went strongly after him in that election and claimed that this man who lost three limbs in Vietnam, who now is in a wheelchair, was weak on national security. So, and they defeated him. And so even there, the fear is real that national security will be used as a club against those who stand up. It's not to say, however, that people ought not to stand up, but it is to say that fear is there. Yes.
Well, I appreciate your initial point that, you know, here are people in the judiciary, and it seems to me your sentiment is well expressed. Can't we trust them? And as you say, they're fallible. And so I think that we have to turn the question back to ourselves. Can we trust ourselves as citizens to take responsibility in a government that we hope is a democracy, however faint that hope gets in the times of the Florida debacle when, you know, there was great intimidation and votes essentially stolen. You know, we can't simply trust that we have a democracy. We don't have a functioning democracy. We have a population that watches a lot of television, hopes that government will take care of us, and, you know, expects that they won't do a great job. But, you know, so many of our neighbors, do you find this true? You know, we're a small group here tonight, and that, you know, you have to think hard. You have to think persistently, and it seems to me that many of our neighbors want something easier than citizenship. You know, we want a sort of childhood in which we just trust the government. And, you know, it seems to me that what we're getting is a police state in which it's not the law that's enforced. It's a decision here or there. Let's arrest this group of people. We won't charge them. We'll take them over in this part of the city and release them if they're inconvenient. Yesterday I was interviewing some people who were riding bicycles through the city en masse. They told me they were obeying traffic laws, stopped at a red light, that the police pulled up. Previously, they believed that there were plainclothes, about 12 plainclothes police on motorcycles weaving in and out dangerously among this great big group of bicyclists, and that they, you know, abruptly pulled up. They were stopped at a red light. The police blockaded them, basically pinned them in, began handcuffing all of them, and arrested them. Now, what law were they breaking? And I think your point has so many echoes throughout our culture. What law are we going to insist upon together, maintain together? You know, or, you know, do we want comfort? and ease, or do we want clarity? Mm-hmm. And even if we're wrong about the laws that we write, as you say, the period of deliberation in which we hope not only Congress will think together and weigh the merits of an idea, which I just love hearing you speak, John. You know, you bring forth the history of, you know, great thinking, clear thinking, and responsible thinking. And in our media, we don't see a lot of that. We see a lot of sensational emotionalism, you know, rather than great ideas now. And so as citizens, you know, how do we assert a higher standard than that?
Well, I think you raise a good point. And the question of what kind of democracy we have, and I think in this time is really related so much to a cultural question of are we going to shut off getting certain messages that aren't palatable, that aren't in a box? And I think we have to go with a bit of complexity. And when you were saying that, I was just thinking that there's a lot of miserable, depressed people in our country right now, and there's a lot of people taking Prozac, and there's a lot of people who just we're kind of promoting this culture of numbness. And I think it's just not in terms of a political shift. It has to be also a cultural shift of embracing all of life, the good and the bad and the ugly and warts and all. And I think once people begin to let all of life invade, you become more awakened, you become joyful, and it's fantastic.
It's responsible that you're alive.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think it's a real cultural issue, because I think what are people listening to Fox News? Well, what is that promoting? To go out and buy a prescribed vacation? I mean, I think it's really linked with media. I think it's a whole complex blob of issues there. But I think it is really encouraging in this moment, because a lot of people are starting, I feel, to wake up. I mean, if you see the photos of the demonstration yesterday, and there were so many expressions of creativity, I thought it was fantastic. Did anybody go to the protest yesterday? I have a question for John, because I'm not exactly familiar with the mechanics of the Vietnam War and mm-hmm. what led up to the Vietnam War. But as I understood, you were saying that perhaps it wasn't officially a declaration, which is the point that Sally was making, but there was some kind of mandate. The mandate, whether it was called a resolution, mm-hmm. it was enacted by Congress?
Well, in actuality, the fact is that the Vietnam War began far before the Gulf of Tonkin Resolution in 1964, and began with Eisenhower sending advisors to Vietnam that President Kennedy then continued to do. But it is true that in 1964, the Gulf of Tonkin Resolution served to escalate the war far more in terms of sending U.S. Troops. And that resolution was based on a claim made by the Johnson administration that has since proven to be false, which is that our ships in the Gulf of Tonkin had come under attack. And therefore, Congress was presented very quickly with this resolution to vote to authorize the president to use whatever force necessary to address the situation in Southeast Asia. And while it's true that some of the language was eerily similar to the language in the October 2002 resolution, that is the chief distinction, that it came in the context of an attack, a claimed attack on our forces in the Gulf of Tonkin. Whereas here, there was no claim being made that we were under attack, and the president himself, you know, and his administration opposed even the use of the word imminent in describing the threat. If anyone goes back and looks at the president's statements before that resolution passed, he did not use the word imminent. He was very careful not to, because he had been clearly trained not to use that word. And even Senator Durbin's amendment to supplement that word for the continuing threat posed by Iraq to say it was imminent was voted down 70-30 in the U.S. Senate. So there was no sudden attack. and therefore this was a future threat, somewhere in the future that we were engaged in trying to preemptively stop, and that was what was so different than the Gulf of Tonkin resolution.
Maybe because of the preemptive war policy that this administration had publicly stated back in 2002, and said that Iraq was going to be the first example of the execution of a preemptive war. They told us that right in the beginning. That almost required the kind of resolution that the administration went to Congress with, this sort of nebulous resolution that allowed them to go ahead and do it. Because what amazed me is why they didn't plant weapons of mass destruction, or why didn't they even sort of fabricate a fake attack. I mean, that's easy to do. They did it in the Mexican War. They did it in the Spanish-American War. They did it in the Vietnam War.
Examples you're using, they didn't have satellites, and now they got a satellite that passes over.
True, but I mean, it might be worth it to them to have created the justification. But I think that they really are trying to set the framework for future preemptive wars here.
Sure.
So this is the kind of resolution that you need.
Sure.
And even that they're willing to stand up and say, it's true we didn't find weapons of mass destruction, but we were still right. And Kerry's willing to say, but I would still vote for it. Mm-hmm. Because he also supports the idea of preemptive war. So, I guess it's just like we're in a new era now, and could we ever go back to this piece of paper?
I think this is a new era, but I don't think it's therefore the only era into the future. I actually don't believe that because we've left a different period of time when, actually up until World War II, the War Powers Clause was much more complied with, that since this erosion has begun to this latest erosion, that now we must just give up this idea that Congress has this power. I think we can go back to it, but it requires we, the people, engaging in this dialogue all across the country and demanding that our leaders uphold the Constitution. Frankly, I mean, regardless of who wins on November 2nd, this question, because of, as you say, the identical nature of the views of Senator Kerry and President Bush on this question, preemptive war, this matter is still going to be with us post November 2nd. This is not an election issue, if you will. And therefore, it makes it even more important that we continue to press our leaders in this country to look at the Constitution and uphold it for what was intended, and to speak out about this. And if they're going to go a different way and decide that they're going to disobey the Constitution, let's have a real debate about whether or not they want to amend the Constitution. And if we want to amend it in post-911 world, let's have that debate. But let's not just by fiat decide that because we've been attacked, as horrific as that was on September 11th, that the president will now have the powers of a king.